Okay, so let's get started. We are here in Revelation chapter 6. Last week, we did verses 1 and 2. So last week was an introduction to the opening of the seven seals. Tonight, I think, and this will obviously depend on how much you guys want to talk and how much I talk, but I would like to see us get through the other three of the first four seals. So there is definitely a break. If you look in verse 9, you'll notice this comment. And when he opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of those who were slain because of the word of God and because of the testimony they had. And they cried in a loud voice saying, and I'm not going to read the whole section here, but what you can see is there's a change in what we're seeing. So the first four seals, every one of the first four seals are opened, and then somebody says, come, and John sees, and behold, there's a horse and a rider upon the horse. So that's seal 1, seal 2, seal 3, seal 4. Seal 5 opens, and what happens when the fifth seal is opened is really kind of strange, is that the action does not take place on earth. The action takes place in heaven. And then we see the sixth seal opened, and then the action begins to take place on earth again. So what we need to see is the first four seals are definitely in a group. They are clustered in a group, seals 1, 2, 3, 4. Then we see seals 5 and 6. Those are kind of clustered into a group as well. And then when the seventh seal is opened, we see another change, because the opening of the seventh seal then brings us into the trumpets. And so what we want to look at tonight is we want to look at seals 2, 3, and 4. So we look at the second seal. And he opens the second seal, and I'm going to read from my translation. I can see here I have a typo. But in my translation, beginning in verse 3, and when he opened the second seal, I heard the second living thing saying, come, and came out another horse, fiery, and the one sitting upon it was given to him to take peace out of the earth, and so that each other they will slay, and was given to him a great sword. And when he opened the third seal, I heard the third living thing say, come. And I saw, and behold, a black horse, and the one sitting upon it was having scales in his hand. And I heard like a voice in the midst of the four living creatures saying, a quart of wheat for a denarius, and three quarts of barley for a denarius, and you shall not unrighteous the oil and the wine. We'll get to that use of the word unrighteous there in a little bit. And when he opened the fourth seal, I heard the fourth living thing saying, come. And I saw, and behold, a green horse, and the one sitting upon him, to him is the name Death, and Hades followed with him, and he was given to them authority upon the fourth of the earth to kill in sword and in famine and in death and by the beasts of the earth. Okay, so last week we opened up with the first of the four horsemen of the apocalypse. Everybody knows these as the four horsemen of the apocalypse, and we're not talking about, you know, those great players of, you know, back in the day for Notre Dame. We're talking about a different set of four horsemen. And these guys, Jim remembers the four horses. He knows what I'm talking about. That's a little before you. I said that, and I'm like, no, that had to be before. Okay, so we opened up the first seal. The Lamb opens up the first seal, and out comes somebody who looks a lot like Jesus. Now, we spent a lot of time last week talking about how this is the Antichrist. Everything about the Antichrist is supposed to look like Jesus, but he's not Jesus. He wants to deceive. That is the entire point of, that's the entire mission of Antichrist, is to bring worship to himself. And of course, then we see later that he will direct worship towards the dragon that gave power to the beast. And so what we have, and a lot of commentators talk about this, a lot of preachers talk, you see this unholy trinity. We see the dragon, which is Satan, which is the false god. We see the Antichrist, who is, of course, the false Christ, and we see the false prophet, who is the false Holy Spirit. All of them are directing the false Holy Spirit, the false prophet, directs worship towards the beast. He makes the world worship the beast who was slain, who was hit, who was struck in the head as though he were dead, and he was raised to life again. And the beast himself, the great beast, the first beast, he directs worship towards the dragon who gives power to the beast. And so we see there, in verses 1 and 2, the rise of Antichrist. Something, I believe, that before the tribulation begins, before these seals are opened, there is a major world conflict. I believe that that is what makes sense of how Antichrist can rise, is there is a major world conflict, and after this major world conflict, people are willing to follow somebody who promises peace. We know from Daniel and other places that the Antichrist is going to promise people peace. Jesus talks about those who say, peace, peace, when there is no peace. People are going to promise peace. They're going to say, hey, we're going to bring peace. In fact, Antichrist, we know from the book of Daniel, is going to bring peace in Jerusalem for 3.5 years. He's somehow going to strike a treaty so that the Jews and the Arabs are no longer at war with each other, and the Jews are able to rebuild the temple on Mount Zion. That is what's going to happen. But this guy is not going to be able to actually bring peace. He is going to bring war. He is going to bring destruction. But he comes with a bow. He comes out. He goes out conquering, and so that he should conquer. But then we see the opening of the second seal. And I heard the living thing, the second living thing. Notice that these four living things also correspond to the four horsemen. Now, that's significant, and this is why that's significant. Let me just pause right here and say this. The four living things that we've already met, the four living creatures, one had the face of a man, one had the face of an eagle, one had the face of an ox, and one had the face of a lion. And yes, of course Jim would know that one. That's you were talking about that. Yeah, so they've got these angels that have these four faces, these living things. There are four of them. The four of them correspond to these four horsemen. Now, this is why this is significant. There are some people who want to say, well, look, the first rider on the white horse is Jesus. He is Jesus. And yeah, the other riders on those horses, they're bad. Those are demons. Those are bad things that are happening. But there's a difference between the first rider and the other three riders. Well, first of all, that's a problem because when we look at the end of the opening of the fourth seal, the rider on the green horse is given authority to kill with sword, famine, death, and the beasts of the earth. Four things. He introduces a new thing that hasn't been mentioned, which is beasts of the earth. So there are three things. So the four things mentioned, him being the fourth and him having the fourth new thing, suggests that all four of these guys go together, right? We see the repetition of four, the four living creatures, the four horsemen, the four modes of death that happen with the fourth horseman of the apocalypse, or the fourth horseman of the fourth seal. So we keep seeing this repetition of four. That suggests that all of these things go together, and they're similar in kind. If the four living creatures are similar, they have the same meaning. If the four seals are part of the same book, then in these four ways of killing are part of the same tribulation period, it would stand to reason that the four horsemen and the four horses they ride, of course, are similar in meaning. And so having a distinction saying, well, the first one is Jesus and the other three, those can be bad stuff, those can be demons, but not the first one. You can say that, but it doesn't really make any sense. It's not fitting in with the flow of what we have written here. I bring that up because there are a decent number of commentators who want to make that argument. You will find that probably the majority of commentators out there want to make Jesus this rider on the white horse. So I'm giving you the minority view, and I think the minority view here is better. Sometimes it's not, but here I think it's better. So he opens the second seal, and we see a horse, and this horse is a fiery horse. Now, what do your translations have for that word fiery? Is it something like red or scarlet, or yours says flaming red? Is that the Amplified that you have? Okay, the flaming red, okay. The NIV here, I'll bust that open. You say red, okay. Yeah. Red, is that, you have the King James, don't you? Yeah, the King James has red. What we're going to see is that there is a cluster of colors that's used also throughout Revelation. We're going to see the word fiery used a lot. And fiery sometimes is used to describe the color red. Like sometimes we're going to see like the colors of armor and stuff like that, and they're going to use this word fiery. But we're also going to see sulfurous and hyacinth colored. So you kind of see red, yellow, and blue. So it's interesting that the primary colors are the ones that are used here, but that's neither here nor there. But we're going to see the repetition of this word fiery. I have translated in my translation fiery as fiery every time, even when it clearly is referring to red, or when it's sulfurous and that clearly refers to something that's yellow colored. I've translated it that way so that we can see throughout the book how John is using the word fiery. But he opens this, And he says, come, and there's another horse, a fiery one, sitting upon it was him to take peace out of the earth, and so that they will slay each other. And by the way, that is two words in Greek. There is a word for each other that's one word. That is two words in Greek. That's why I broke that up. And they will and they will slay, and was given to him a great sword. And so this guy comes out, and he is going to kill people with a sword. What do you guys think that this represents? I would say that this is all of this is taking place after the rapture. Yeah, that's my take on this. So yeah, anarchy. Certainly, we're going to see anarchy. That is like really what's going on in the book of Revelation. If I'm reading this aright, is what we see is we see one great world ruler who is promising peace, and he's given power, at least nominal power, and he is trying to take authority. But he's facing resistance. He's facing conflict, and he has to. And there are wars that are fought. And so, I think that there is anarchy in the sense that there is, after Antichrist rises. So we see the first one comes. He goes out conquering and to conquer. A crown is given to him, a Stephanos, a conqueror's crown, a victor's crown. He's given this crown. He goes out. He has authority, but not everyone gives in to him. And he's not able to actually keep his promise of peace that he's promised. And war breaks out in the world. I think that, and again, the possession of a great sword here is probably indicative that this is death that comes through battle, not simply death that happens through other means. And we can see that there's a distinction between the third seal and the fourth in the means through which death come. And so we see that, you know, the rider on the white horse came with a bow. And he goes out to conquer and conquering. This guy comes out with a great sword so that the people of the earth, notice that it's not this rider who's going out killing. At least if I'm reading this correctly, he goes out, it was given to him to take peace out of the earth and so that each other they will slay, and was given to him a great sword. He's given a great sword, but his power is to make men slay each other. He makes people slay each other. And so he doesn't appear to actually be doing any of the killing. He is simply going out and bringing death upon the world. Now, some people say that, well, the red horse is probably the false prophet. He's the beast out of the earth. He's the beast that has horns like a lamb but speaks like a serpent, like a dragon. And you can make that argument, but it's not a very strong one, because then what do you do? How do you identify the third and the fourth horseman? And so that's the problem you run into when you want to start a pattern, but you can't complete it, which is good to know. What do you guys think it would take for war to break out in this world? Real war. Let me rephrase that, because that's a kind of a difficult question, a pretty open-ended question. Let me ask this first. Do you think it would be really difficult for major warfare to break out in this world today? Everybody's saying no? Okay. Can we anticipate I can think of a couple scenarios where war could break out. You know, if China invades Taiwan and America decides to uphold her commitments, if Russia invades, you know, Western Europe, I could see that. There are a lot of potential ways, at least today, where you could see major war erupt. If the Arab League unites together against Israel, war could break out. If Turkey and Russia and Afghanistan and Iran unite against the European powers, you could see major war break out. I mean, for all we know, Mexico could invade Texas tomorrow. We don't know. But there are several likely geopolitical scenarios right now where you could see global conflict. And it's very funny, because when men are saying peace, peace, that's when war comes. When World War I happened, no one thought it was going to happen. I mean, if I don't know if any of you guys have studied the First World War, but there were all these treaties, and everybody thought all of these treaties would lead to a war so great that no one would ever have it, and so everyone would back down. There is no way that Germany and Austria and Turkey would want to go to war against Russia, England, and France. They would never do it. They would never do it. And all of these alliances they thought would bring world security. It was this whole idea that Europe has been in love with of, you know, England wants to keep people at each other's throats, because a strong Germany or a strong France or a strong Russia is bad for England, because that means England gets cut out of the commerce trade. You know, so England's trying to constantly keep each other at their throat, so they're making alliances. And, you know, France and Russia are always kind of wanting to ally with each other. Germany and Russia are always trying to be allies with each other. And everybody thought, ha, look at all these alliances we have, all these treaties. Somebody's going to back down. And then nobody backed down. And then people realized another thing, which is we've all borrowed a lot of money from America. And if we lose, we're going to have to pay back that money to America. So we got to make sure we win. And so everybody doubles down. Let's just call a truce, because you have to win, because you have to have unconditional surrender or from your opponent so that you have a basis for negotiating getting paid back. And then what do? England couldn't afford to lose that war. England had to lose that war. They'd be bankrupt. Same thing with France. Russia already fell. Russia fell to the communists, and we saw a century of death and misery in the Soviet Union because of that. And all when everybody thought there was going to be peace. Everybody thought no one will go to war. And then what happens after the First World War? Neville Chamberlain, you guys remember what he promised, right? Peace in our day. Peace in our day. And then later, Hermann Göring, I believe it was Hermann Göring said, if the Czechs had decided to fight us, we would have lost. If we had had to fight in the mountains of Czechoslovakia, in the mountains of Bohemia, and France had invaded Germany from the west, with France had something like 100 divisions at that time, they said Germany would have gotten rolled over. They were not ready. They fought before they were ready, but everybody bought Hitler's bluff. And by the time they invaded Poland, it was too late because they had gotten all the kinks worked out. Neville Chamberlain, we're going to have peace in our day. No, we don't. The UN's promising peace. Really, the two great belligerent powers are going to promise peace. Russia and China, who constantly invade other countries, they're going to promise. Okay. They're going to. And America's not a whole lot better. We've invaded a lot of people. But anyways, I say all that to say, I think that we can all see that warfare is never very far away. In recorded history, there have been, I think, less than 400 years, like 400 individual years, when there hasn't been a major world conflict. That doesn't say a whole lot for the human race. He opened the third seal, and a third living creature, the third living thing, said, "Come," and I saw, and behold, a black horse, and the one sitting upon it was having scales in his hand. And I heard like a voice in the midst of the four living creatures saying, "Quart of wheat for a denarius, and 3 quarts of barley for a denarius, and you shall not unrighteous the oil and the wine." I'll come to that word unrighteous here in a second, but I wanted to show you guys this. This is about as close as I can figure to the Greek measure of a koinex. I believe it's pronounced koinex. I'd have to look that up. I'm not going to bother looking it up right now. This is the measure of wheat. This is about a quart of wheat. And that is the measure that it would take a denarius. A denarius at that time was considered a day's wages for a day labor, which would have been a labor of any kind, which would have been the vast majority of people. Now, here's the thing. Does anybody know off the top of their head how many calories are in this? This is about a pound and a half of wheat berries. Come on, farmer's wife. How many calories we got in here? Not enough? Yeah? Not enough. About 600. 624. 624 calories. This would be a day's wages of wheat. Now, wheat in that time was the universal staple. The Roman Empire had a nonstop fleet of Alexandrian grain ships that were flowing from Alexandria, Egypt. They were coming up around the coast of the Mediterranean, and then they would dock in Rome. They'd float up the Tiber, and they would unload their grain because you had to feed the Roman people. And Rome, the empire, had grown so big, and they had so many crops and all this other stuff, so many specialty crops, that it was cheaper to get Alexandrian grain and ship it all over the world. In fact, that was Paul's ship. The ship that Paul came to Rome on was an Alexandrian grain ship. And this was so important. This flow of grain was so important in the Roman world that they would have Roman centurions, and the whole Roman army was in charge of this fleet of grain ships, these old barges that floated around. This is a very serious thing. But here's the deal. Wheat is not is calorie dense as other cereal crops. It has a high protein count. This is a complete protein, and it's really good for you, but it's relatively not very calorie dense. Barley, so wheat berries of hard white winter wheat is about 26 calories an ounce. Barley is about 100 calories an ounce. Barley is a much more calorie dense food. Here's the problem. In the ancient world, barley was not considered fit for human consumption. Barley was considered if you were eating barley, you were very low class. Barley was what you fed animals with. You fed horses, and of course you made beer with it, but they also fed gladiators. So you fed slaves with barley. And in fact, they used to call the gladiators the barley munchers because they would consume so much barley. Barley, 3 quarts of barley would equal about 7,200 calories a day. Now, in the ancient world, and estimates vary, a Roman soldier on campaign had rations of 3,700 calories a day, which is about what modern American soldiers get per day, is what they figure. Well, not just modern American, modern soldiers today with all of their gear, which weighs about the same. Armor has weighed about the same all throughout history. People have been very good at figuring out how much a person can carry and still be effective at fighting, and it's around 70 pounds. And so to carry your 70 pounds and to do all the things that you needed to do to march, they needed about 3,700 calories a day. That means that you can support two people on a day's wages of Roman soldiers if they're just eating barley. And that's all your money goes to is just eating this barley. If you've got a family, however, you're going to be in trouble, because a person who was just normal people, they figure it's probably about the same from estimates we have, is they were eating anywhere between 19 and 2,700 calories a day is what people were eating back then. Now, obviously, when your metabolism slows down, if you don't have as much food, you can live on less, but you're not going to be living your best life. And so what this means is a day's wages, after this war has broken out, a day's wages will not give you enough food to live on. If you're eating wheat and you're just one man trying to feed himself and you're insisting on, no, I'm eating wheat, I'm not eating that trash barley, you will die. You will not be getting enough calories to live. If you have a family, you better keep your family pretty small, because you would only be able to feed about 3 adults on 3 quarts of barley per day. So what happens is things get really bad. Now, none of you guys are old enough to remember rationing, are you? You remember rationing? What did you think about rationing? There's a really interesting documentary series. If you guys like documentaries, it's called the Wartime Farm. It was a BBC documentary, and these guys are archaeologists, and they go and they try to set up a historical farm to meet World War II British specifications, because British rationing was harsh. I mean, they're a tiny island nation, and they had been living on American and Canadian grain for a long time, and they had become specialist farmers. You know, they were raising cattle, they were raising dairy cows, they had pigs, they had sheep. They had gotten American grain so cheap and Canadian grain so cheap that all the farmers in England who caught the clue stopped growing cereal crops. I mean, maybe they grew enough barley so that they could malt their beer, you know, for their local pubs, but they were not growing cereal crops. The English were living really good lives then. People were eating a lot of meat. People were having a lot of butter, a lot of milk. But when war came, they said, we've got to turn every inch of arable soil to growing cereal crops to feed the people, to feed the army, to feed the nation. And they did. And it was harsh. Their rationing was really... Now, you could eat all the bread you wanted, but you didn't do so well on meat, and your butter, you didn't get a lot of butter either, but you could get a lot of bread. But what happens in war is what always happens. What we see here is starvation comes, because this is not enough to live on. I mean, people will be starving on this. And in the ancient world, living without oil and wine, because this will only buy you your grain. This isn't considering oil, wine, these other things that are staples. Because guess what? In the ancient world, you can't drink the water. You cannot drink the water. There were a few places where you could drink the water. I admit that. There were a few places where you could drink the water and it was safe. But by and large, you did not drink water out of a well. It would poison you. The only way you touched well water was if it was mixed with wine, so that the alcohol in the wine would kill the germs. People didn't drink water, generally. They drank very weak wine, or they drank really weak beer. They drank beer de table, is the French word. They drank table beer. They drank weak stuff, so they didn't know exactly why it worked, but they knew that you wouldn't get sick if you mixed your water with your wine. They knew that you didn't just drink the water. People can't afford it now. So what do you see? You see people that are starving. You see people, especially children, that are getting sick because they have to drink impure water. And of course, as society breaks down, it's not like the water is going to get any cleaner. We see all of this happening. We see societal breakdown. But notice what we also see. And Jim already mentioned this. Do not harm the oil and the wine. Now you said, Jim, that if you had the money, you could get pretty much whatever you wanted under rationing. This is not going to hurt the rich. The rich and powerful are not going to be harmed by the plague of famine that strikes the world. The people who have money, the people who have resources, they'll make sure they have oil and wine. There was a guy I knew years ago. Well, I still know him, and he's still a guy. But a friend of mine was talking after 2008. And in 2008, you guys remember the crash in 2008, and everything went bad. And I said, man, where's a man supposed to put his money nowadays? And he said, I'd buy stock in beer and cigarettes. And I said, why beer and cigarettes? He says, because no matter how poor people are, they always have money for beer and cigarettes. People are going to get it. People are going to get their beer and their cigarettes. People, you know, doesn't matter if your family's starving. They're going to get their beer and their cigarettes. And go ahead. Wartime Farm. Wartime Farm. You can find it on the BBC. It's available on YouTube for free. Obviously, you can also pay for it through BBC. But paying for stuff is expensive, as we see in this text here so far. But we see that the wealthy are not going to be harmed. In fact, there's Dr. McGee talks about in his teaching on this area that he knew a guy during World War II. He was a wealthy guy, and he said, I had a big fat T-bone steak every time I wanted throughout the whole war. Never missed out on one. And another man says, he said, you know, with these wages, it'll be steak and potatoes for one person alone. It'll be macaroni and cheese for a family. And even that's pretty generous because I don't know that I would call one meal's worth of bread, steak, and potatoes, but you get the point. And so we see what's happening. We see the bringing of war, and what follows war, we see famine and destruction. After the Russians conquered Berlin, Berlin was a nightmare of a city. I mean, you take away the tens of thousands, and some people theorize up to 100,000 rapes that happened when the Red Army marched into Berlin, and all of the murders and reprisals that happened. But then what happened in the economy of Berlin was what happens in the economy of every city that falls to invading soldiers. You're robbed, you're pillaged, and the only way to get stuff is through prostitution or crime. Society breaks down. And so in post-war Germany, cigarettes were currency, just like it is in prison. You know, cigarettes and foodstuffs, chocolate, things like that, that was their currency. And of course, so were women and girls. They were also considered currency. But that's what we're going to see. We're going to see after the war, we're going to see, and probably during the war as well, we're going to see this black horse who comes in and he brings starvation and destruction with him. And of course, like we mentioned, we will continue to see a very large gap between the rich and everybody else. The rich, they're not going to be harmed. They're going to be okay. And then when he opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth living thing saying, come, and I saw, and behold, a green horse, and the one sitting upon it, to him is the name the Death, and the Hades followed with him, and was given to them, notice not just him now, notice given to them, to Hades and death, the authority upon the fourth of the earth to kill in sword and in famine and in death and by the beasts of the earth. The first thing I want us to note is a lot of Bibles have a pale horse, right? That's the classic King James Version that probably everybody came to memorize is, and behold, a pale horse, and the one sitting upon, and the one who sat upon him was death, and hell followed with him, right? That's kind of what we've all memorized. But the word is chloros, like the word chlorine, right? And in Mark, we read about how the people sat down on the chlorochortos, the green grass. And we actually see this same word chloros used in Revelation to describe green grass. All the chlorochortos, all the green grass is burned up when one of the woes or one of the plagues, or maybe it's wormwood, the comet wormwood, something comes and it burns up a third of the green grass in the world and a third of the green trees and a third of the stuff. And so it's the idea of like a pale green, like the color of vegetation. And that's the color of this horse. And that's interesting as well because the three horses that have come so far have been white, red, and black. Those are all natural colors of horses. I mean, you know, maybe Secretariat wasn't as bright red as a fire engine, but he was pretty red. I mean, people look at some horses and they say, that's a red horse. You know, those are natural colors. My wife's hair is pretty red. Her sister's hair is even redder. Emily's more of an orange, but, you know, you see some pretty red colors in nature. I have never, I've seen green hair, but I've never seen naturally green hair. You know, a friend of mine went to the Fulton County Fair, and he said, I just like people watching, and you find all the purple hairs and green hairs and blue hairs. I said, yeah, you do, but I've never seen a green horse. I mean, maybe in Wizard of Oz, but I've never seen a green horse in nature. It doesn't exist. There's something deeply unnatural about this. White horse, black horse, red horse, natural colors. They're significant, but they're natural. Here we see a green horse, and the one that sits upon him is death, and Hades follows with him. And so what we see is death, and Hades here does not mean hell in the sense that we think of where hell is the place of eternal torment where people suffer. Hades here means the grave or death, and obviously there's a lot behind this word we could talk about if you guys are interested, but the idea is that the one sitting upon the green horse is death. It is death personified, and we see throughout the New Testament death is personified often. Paul talks about death as though death is a person with a will. We see death here personified. And this is the only one who's named, by the way. This is the only one who's identified. The other one we have, he's the rider on the white horse. He goes out with a bow. He goes out conquering and to conquer. The one on the red horse, it was given to him a sword. The one on the black horse was given to him scales. This one has a name, and his name is Death. Death and Hades follows with him. And they, death and the grave, were given authority upon the fourth of the earth to kill. Notice before, the first horse has authority. He has a bow, but we don't see him using the bow. The second horseman, I should say, he makes men kill each other. He doesn't do the killing. And then the black horse, the one with the scales, he simply declares what the prices are going to be. He seems to be controlling world markets and world economies. This one is actively killing, actively destroying. And so we see a progression as we look through the horses, the horsemen, of how active they are in their work. The first horseman, he comes to bring peace, and he does. After a fashion and for a time, he brings peace. And people hail him. He's given a crown. He's given a Stephanos. He achieves it. He conquers, but he's got a bow, but we don't see him using the bow. The second one, he makes men do this. The third one is actively controlling world markets. He's not killing people, but he's got the scales. And this one, he and death, death and his partner, the grave, Hades, they go around and they have the authority and they do the killing. And they kill with sword and with famine and with death. And now we see the last one that's mentioned, the beasts of the earth. What does that mean, do you guys suppose? What does it mean that they are able to kill by the beasts of the earth? They're hungry too. That is absolutely one of the interpretations of people who are taking this revelation, looking through these very literalistically, is if starvation is this rampant, and if we've got all these dead bodies and all these, you know, sick and weak people, a lot of animals are going to come out and get rather more aggressive. And so that's one take on it, absolutely. And I think that's probably at least in part true. Because, I mean, animals kill people today, you know. Go ahead. Yeah, so another one of those interpretations is exactly what you said, is that the beasts are representative of the armies of the world and the rulers of the world. And again, later on when we get through here, we're going to spend an extensive amount of time going through Daniel, through those prophetic passages in Daniel. But what do we see? We see beasts in Daniel, right? We see a leopard, a four-winged leopard. We see a bear with one side up higher than the other. We see the terrifying beast. We see the ram with the horns that charges about. We see these, or the shaggy goat. We see these animals in Daniel. And we see the ram and the shaggy goat. We see the leopard with wings. We see the bear with one side. We see the frightening beast, which represents the Roman Empire. And there's one that I'm forgetting. I can't think of. But definitely, world rulers are considered, are personified with animals. And to this day, we still do it, right? Like, we still look at Russia as the bear. America is the eagle. England is the lion. Like, we still use these animal symbols for nations. And so I think that not only is it, you know, not only would that make sense contemporary, I mean, Canada's the maple leaf, and that's not really intimidating, but, you know, they're not really trying to be intimidating. But we've got that idea, and it is in the contemporary world, but it's certainly in biblical prophecy, is that the rulers or the kingdoms of the world are represented with these beasts, with these animal natures. So I think that's almost certainly, at least in part, true. Other ideas here on what this might represent or what this might mean? Yeah, absolutely. And that is another one of the views is we'll get to the Wuhan part about like the source of it, but bacteria are creatures. They are living things. And I know that there's a debate in the scientific community on whether viruses are actually living things or not, but I mean, they don't belong to kingdom Animalia, but you know, could you conceivably call the bacteria a beast? Well, it's a living thing. We know that there is some conscious, if you want to call it, conscious probably isn't the right word, but, you know, they respond to their environment. And so can you call those beasts? I mean, maybe. But even if not, even if you don't want to call the bacteria beasts, like you mentioned with the coronavirus, as far as we know, and I don't know how much we actually know and how much we're being told that's not true, but this coronavirus supposedly came from a strain of bat coronavirus. And look at the diseases we've had just in golly, since I got out of high school. What have we had? A couple bouts of avian flu, swine flu, and now bat flu with COVID. SARS, yeah, the first round of SARS. Oh, what's that? Ebola? Yeah, a lot of these are being transported by animals. And what did we see in the medieval world? Bubonic plague. I mean, plague was carried by fleas, which were carried by rats, but it's the beasts of the earth that are carrying this. And bubonic plague, we believe, may have been the plague that struck Athens. I mean, the bubonic plague, and it, by the way, it still exists in the world. People have forgotten that it's still out there. We're like, oh, well, we took care of it. It's like, well, no, we didn't. We didn't. Smallpox was cured by cowpox, but cowpox still isn't, like, something that's totally great, but it will make you immune. But plague has existed maybe all the way from Athens. And some people theorize that what struck the Philistines was bubonic plague. I don't know of any evidence that's verified that, but people theorize. I mean, this is a thing that's been around, and they keep finding it. It keeps showing up. They haven't gotten rid of it. And the last huge plague bout, I think, was in France in the 1800s. There was another huge bout of plague. But it's not entirely gone away. And again, carried by fleas, carried by rats. You know, you look at New York City, and good golly, they got some rats there, right? You look at the major cities, it wouldn't take much. It would not take much to bring something like that. And again, like, I think your point is, disease is carried by these animals. Even if it's not actual animals attacking people, which very well could be the case, but the disease that's carried by animals it's a serious thing. What I mean, you look at the potential for disease, even animal-to-animal disease. You know, I have a friend, I used to help raise cattle for him. He works for the Ohio Department of Agriculture. And his great fear is that as we go to more and more of our livestock farming being done in just a small number of these super-duper ultra-mega farms, remember, 2 years ago? A couple chickens got sick, and half the country couldn't get eggs. What if a deer wanders on? What if a deer with tuberculosis wanders into a cattle farm, and that cattle farm is producing milk and meat for all over? I mean, these all of this centralization and factory making of farming, you can debate whether that's good or not, but it certainly makes us susceptible to animal disease interrupting our food supply. I don't know if you guys know this, but China has a strategic pork reserve. Yeah, that was exactly my response when I heard about it. What? China has a strategic pork reserve. They keep pork in reserve, so they always have so much of it strategically. Like we have strategic oil reserve, they've got a strategic pork reserve. I'm not sure if it's all frozen. I'm not sure how they do it. Do you know? Okay. I don't know how they do it. I don't know if it's meat that's always kept frozen and they wait until they replenish their supply and then they can sell, or if it's they have to have so many animals that they don't cull at any given time. I'm not sure how they do it, but I know they have one. And because their people have gotten a taste of meat. They're tired of just eating rice and starving. They have gotten accustomed to pork and they want more of it, and they're not going to not have it. And so you think about the potential for starvation if our food supplies get interrupted like that. I mean, it could be dramatic. The last interpretation I want to throw out here, all of these I think are true. All of these I think are going to certainly happen when this happens. And so I don't think that this symbol means only one thing. And like you said, the green horse, a lot of people have described this horseman as either plague or pestilence. People have given names to these guys. Obviously, his name is Death, but people have talked about the other one as war, as famine, and as either plague or pestilence or death. I've heard those names thrown about there. But the last interpretation I want you to consider is the way that this guy is described, is the beasts of the earth. And when you look at the beasts of the earth, that word is a significant word. Why would the word beast be significant here? Anybody want to take a stab at it? Could be rulers, and Deanne had mentioned that, and I think that's probably at least in part true. But there's specifically one or two rulers that I think are significant here. The word here is Therion. Therion. And Therion, or it's actually Therion, it's the plural, Therion. But that word beast is used, I believe, 31 times in the book of the Revelation. Of the 31 times, this is the only one that might not explicitly refer to either the Antichrist or the false prophet. Every other instance in the book of Revelation refers to either the Antichrist or the false prophet. Now that's significant. Now that doesn't mean that patterns can't be broken. Patterns can be broken. But this is the first mention of that word. And so it would stand to reason to me that maybe as you're reading through this and you hear that they're going to be killed by the beasts of the earth, and you're like, okay, well, what does that mean they're going to be killed by the beasts of the earth? And then as you continue to read, as John continues to talk about this, you keep hearing this expression, the beast, the beast, the beast, the beast, the beast. And every single time, it's referring to the man of lawlessness. It's referring to the king who exalts himself. It's referring to Antichrist. And notice, John does not anywhere in the Revelation use the term Antichrist. He does not use it. He uses the word Antichrist in his epistles. But John does not use the word Antichrist here. He only uses the word beast to describe him, and the rider on the white horse. Those are the only two descriptors we see. And admittedly, the rider on the white horse is debatable. You can say it's Jesus. I don't think that's true, but you can say that. But the only other explicit title for Antichrist is the beast. He's not called any of those other names. And so as you read through this, when you read through it the first time and you're like, okay, so this green horse is going to kill by the beast. This rider on the green horse is going to kill by the beast of the earth. The first time you hear that, you're trying to make sense of it, and you're like, okay, well, animals kill people, and then you hear that they're going to kill a fourth of the earth with war, pestilence, famine, and the beast of the earth. And you're like, wow, that's a lot. I mean, right now, that's like 1.7 billion people dead. That's significant. And I know that there are a lot of people who would like that. There are plenty of neo-Malthusians out there that think the world population is way too high. I mean, incidentally, have you ever noticed that all these rich people that think the world population should be around, you know, 1,500,000, they always think they should be one of the 500,000 that are on the list? I mean, you know, you wonder when Bill Gates is out there saying how we need to cut the world population, Bill Gates thinks he's going to be one of the special, wonderful people. You know, hey Bill, how do you think we ought to figure this? Who should we keep of the million people out of the billion? Who should we keep? How do you think we should do it, Bill? He said, I think we should do it by money. Do it by money. It's like so all the Russian gangsters are like, yes, that sounds great. Let's do it by money. You know, so they're all into that. You know, and the Chinese billionaires, they like that. But you know, so what's it going to be? Bill Gates and the Walmart family, you know, that just them and a couple Russian mobsters, they're going to be the only ones left over? Well, you do it by smarts. Well, I guess Bill's okay there, too, and a bunch of eggheads. But as Dr. McGee has pointed out, you know, the eggheads are the ones that keep promising us peace. The JFK, his brain trust, you know, they were gonna solve the Vietnam War. They were going to fix it. They didn't do a great job of that. You know, we keep seeing all these super duper smart people, and they keep getting into government, and they keep promising that they're gonna solve poverty. Last I checked, they're still poor people. They're gonna end war. Last I checked, there's still war. They're gonna end hunger. Their kids still kids starving. The people of the world, these eggheads haven't solved the world's problems. But anyways, sorry, I got sidetracked. I apologize. But the beast of the earth, after you read this over and over, you realize, I think that the beast of the earth here also refer to the Antichrist and the false prophet. They come in peace, but then war breaks out and they reveal their hand. They're not the real peace bringers. They're going to come and they're going to bring death and destruction on a scale that has never been seen before. Never been seen before. And they're going to bring death and destruction. And we have not seen anything like that. Order of the world dying in a very short span of time. It would be like the end of days. Here it will be. But when the plague was ravaging Europe, it was, estimates, you know, vary, but between 20 and 33%, between a fifth and a third of Europe was wiped out because of the Black Plague. And what did people say? This is the end of the world. People couldn't even fathom that the world could continue with that much death and destruction. And of course, what came with it was all the social upheaval that came with it. But people are going to be thinking the same thing. This is the end. This is the end. But anyways, what do you got? Do you guys have any questions or comments or things that you think I've just plain missed? Or yeah, it does sound like a scary place to be. I don't intend to be there. Now some people they think the church is going to go through this, and I can't make Jesus come and rapture us out, but I don't plan to be here. I don't hope to be here.